this morning. My name is Tom Cross, and I'm a technologist. I'm actually the CTO of a local software startup that does information security stuff. I've also spent a lot of time in my life reading and working on civil liberties issues, and I've spoken at this Electronic Frontiers Forum many times over the years, including some of the early ones in the late 1990s. This is a talk that has sort of been burning inside of me for a couple of years, and I'm really excited to have a forum and a bunch of people to share it with, so thank you for coming out. It's a lot of content, and so I'm asking you guys to hold questions until the end. If we don't end up having time to discuss questions in here, then we will go outside and I'll answer any questions you got. But I want to get through the content, and I want to make sure that I'm doing my time management right, so just hold questions till the end. This talk really has an origin in a debate that was sparked by the disclosures that came out of Edward Snowden in 2013. You really saw some polarized perspectives. I've got a lot of friends in the civil liberties community. I also have a lot of friends in the intelligence community. And the perspectives that these two groups of people have about what was disclosed are really irreconcilable. A lot of those people sought to frame their perspective about what was disclosed in terms of, you know, what the founders thought, which is a thing that Americans have a tendency to do. So here's one example. The civil libertarians arguing that the founding fathers would be, you know, rolling in their grave if they knew, what was going on here over the past decade or so. Rand Paul is a good example of someone who uses that kind of rhetoric. And then, on the other side of the coin, here's an essay in Foreign Policy. If George Washington were alive, he'd be reading your email. This is written by a guy named Stephen Knott, who's a professor at the Naval War College. I remember reading this essay in particular, and let me talk about a few things that it says. It says, it's a distortion of history to assume that these tactics run counter to the principles and practices of the nation's founders. The founding fathers were engaged in covert mail opening throughout this Revolutionary War. Certainly none of the founders spoke about a right to privacy. President Abraham Lincoln routinely intercepted private telegraph communications. None of this was seen as a violation of the Fourth Amendment. I'm being a bit charitable in my pull quotes here. He actually links the words right to privacy in this article to the court case Griswold versus Connecticut, which, if you know a thing or two about law, is an implication that the concept of privacy was invented whole cloth in the 1960s. I know enough about the history to know that I disagreed with this. I know that, for example, Benjamin Franklin, when he was the royal postmaster for the colonies before the American Revolution, required his employees to say an oath that they would not open anyone's mail without authorization, and they would prevent the mail from being read without authorization. So obviously the idea that mail should be private is something that the founders understood. At the time, I didn't know enough about the history to truly refute this point of view. There's going to be a couple of digressions in this talk, and right now I'm going to engage in a little bit of a digression. Every, and I emphasize the word every, political faction in our country engages in this sort of rhetorical technique where you have people who take a look at a situation and they select a set of facts about that situation that add up to a particular conclusion, and they write these essays where they say fact one, fact two, fact three, here's the conclusion. These essays are very difficult to combat for us civilians if you go research this, you look up fact one, it turns out it's true. And if you look up fact three, it turns out it's true. And if you look up fact five, it turns out it's true. And if you think about it, 1 + 3 + 5 = 9. And so this essay seems to be a holistic piece of information that is irrefutable. And it has a particular conclusion attached to it. In order to be able to sort of immunize yourself against this kind of partisan argumentation, you actually have to know more about the underlying subject than the people who are writing these essays, and that's really difficult for people to do. There's a great demand for the essay number 9 and the essay number 6. People want you to validate the interests of their faction and tell them that their faction is awesome and they should get everything that they want and no one else's interests matter. And they love it when you do that, particularly if you're really good at it, if you're really well informed, they will pay you for it. You'll get a tenured university position, you'll get a job at a think tank, you'll get a radio show, or people will buy your books. There's a lot of money in it, and people tend to do what they get paid for. Nobody likes Mr. Purple 15. No one's interested in the idea that things are complicated and that compromises are going to have to be made. Nobody makes money writing essays like Mr. Purple 15. People get paid a lot of money to write either 9 or 6. And unfortunately for us, unless you have a full-time job researching these topics, it's hard to know more than these people do about them. And so it's difficult to know the additional facts that they're leaving out of their narrative and why those facts add up to a different conclusion. With that, let's talk about surveillance during the colonial era. So if we're going to talk about surveillance, obviously we need to talk about the Fourth Amendment. And the Fourth Amendment starts out in this building. Anyone know what this building is? It's in Boston. It is the old estate house in Boston. So when Massachusetts was a British colony, this was the main government building. It housed the legislature and the court. And it's still there. Well, I'll get to that in a minute. So back in 1761, a number of your founding fathers, including John Hancock, hired this guy named James Otis, who was sort of a firebrand attorney, to protest this thing called the Writs of Assistance. So the Writs of Assistance allowed customs agents to obtain general warrants that allowed them to break into warehouses or people's homes or anywhere that they thought they might find goods that had been smuggled into the country without taxes paid. And so James Otis goes to this court that was in this building, and he makes this argument, and it's this sort of long-winded argument that he makes. He starts out by saying, a man's home is his castle, which is sort of a legal fiction that had been promoted by a few English intellectuals, and he says, you can't have, general warrants are not constitutional. You have to specifically describe the things that you're going to search when you get a warrant. And he goes further, and he points out that at the time, the line between professional law enforcement and individual citizens was a lot more blurry than it is right now. And so anybody could get a writ of assistance. And he says, what a scene does this open? And he talks about neighbors who hate each other getting writs of assistance and then vindictively raiding each other's houses. And then he, talking about selling past clothes, he goes on to explain that, Massachusetts doesn't have any representation in British Parliament. And so it's not right for the British to tax Massachusetts if the American colonists do not have representation in the British Parliament. So this whole taxation without representation argument that you're familiar with from grade school, it is James Otis's argument, and it is first made in this courtroom in 1761 when he's trying to get the court to overturn the writs of assistance. So amongst the people assembled that day in the court is a young John Adams, who is enthralled with this argument and says that, everyone left the courtroom that day, ready to take up arms against the British government. And he says, he's writing years later when he says this, he says, then and there was the first scene of opposition to the arbitrary claims of Great Britain. Then and there, the child of independence was born. A couple things. So first of all, those of you who've been, who may have read some of the Red partisan essays that talk about the problem with judges being activist judges and legislating from the bench, I want to point out that this is the origin point of the American Revolution. And it is a bunch of your founding fathers in a courtroom asking a judge to invalidate a statute that had been on the books for 100 years because they felt that it violated a constitutional right that no court had before recognized. That's something to keep in mind. And Otis agitated about this for years afterward. There are a number of people who were his clients who ended up in confrontations with customs officials over the next 10 years who seemed to operate with a very perfect understanding of the law and had been coached to sort of create confrontations with customs officials that would lead to an opportunity for Otis to go back into court and argue about this more. Otis also wrote up his arguments, and they were disseminated by the Sons of Liberty, and so that's why everyone talks about no taxation without representation. This is where it comes from. So you can visit this building. I went to Boston on a business trip a few years ago, and then because I'm a privacy guy and an InfoSec guy, I was familiar with this case. I had read it, but I had no idea where it took place. And so I just, like, I'm in this building because it's a thing you see when you're a tourist in Boston, and I'm in the courtroom, and they have a plaque about it there. They change their exhibits around, so it's not always there, but I'm reading the plaque, and I'm like, wow, I am standing in the courtroom where this happened, where the concept of the Fourth Amendment and the idea of American independence were actually born. So by all means, go visit it. So, Otis was agitating for opportunities to get into court to argue about this some more, there's another individual who was successful at that, and his name is John Wilkes. Not John Wilkes Booth, although it's quite likely that John Wilkes Booth was named for this guy, and don't let that color your judgment of him. So he was not an American, he was British, and he was a member of Parliament, and he did not like the Prime Minister. In fact, his problem with the Prime Minister was that he felt that England had accepted too many concessions in the settlement at the end of the Seven Years' War, what we call the French and Indian War. And so he published this, I'm going to call it a zine, which he attacked the Prime Minister over and over and over and over and over and over again. The zine was called The North Briton because the Prime Minister was Scottish. So eventually what happens is the Prime Minister sort of ghostwrites a speech for the King, which the King delivers, which is very complimentary of this settlement at the end of the Seven Years' War. And so John Wilkes gets a hold of this thing, and he writes North Briton number 45, where he trashes this speech that the King gave. And as we know, King George III was not the best king, perhaps, that the UK ever had. So he issues this general warrant for the arrest of John Wilkes and any of his co-conspirators and the seizure of any of their seditious paperwork. And so, officers go out and they haul some, I think, 49 people into jails. John Wilkes is put in the Tower of London. John Wilkes sues. And he argues, first of all, that general warrants are unconstitutional, that you have to specifically describe the things that you're seizing and the places that you're searching. He's actually successful, but not necessarily for that reason. The linchpin of his court case is that he's a minister of parliament, and at the time, ministers of parliament were exempted from prosecution for seditious libel. So in any event, he actually gets a judgment against the people who, like, raided his house. The Sons of Liberty, back here in the colonies, are enthralled with this guy because he's standing up to the King and he's actually successful, and they view his victory in court as a vindication of all their ideas. And so they start having these parties. And on the 45th day of the month, which happens to be Valentine's Day, otherwise I would totally throw one of these, they would have 45 people stand up and give 45 toasts to 45 different civil liberties. At Colonial Williamsburg, they have this bowl, and I haven't been there in a long time. I don't know the actual provenance of this bowl, but it's got the engraving of John Wilkes on it. It was probably a very expensive thing, and it may have been, something they might have used for those ceremonies. There's a bunch of things named for John Wilkes. So here in Georgia, there's a Wilkes County. Charles Pratt is the judge who found in Wilkes' favor, and he also handed down a few other rulings that supported the development of the Fourth Amendment. He was the Earl of Camden, and so you may have heard of Camden, New Jersey, was named after him. In Baltimore, there's a Pratt Street and a Camden Street. The Baltimore Orioles play at Camden Yard. Employees of the NSA, when they go to a baseball game, probably go see the Baltimore Orioles play, and I wonder how many of them realize that they're watching baseball at a stadium that is named for one of the progenitors of the Fourth Amendment. This causes this idea that, warrants should be specific to spread throughout colonial culture. And then George III does another very stupid thing called the Townshend Acts, which were one of the last straws leading up to the Revolution. Amongst the various stupid things that this Townshend Acts did was an expansion of the use of writs of assistance. And so it started out, it was just Massachusetts over here. They used them a lot in the UK. But in every colony, the customs officials were going to the court saying, I want a writ of assistance. And the courts, now these judges had issued general warrants for other purposes for a long time, but they had started to hear that, you know, these general warrants might not be good, and, you know, they didn't like the British customs guys anyway, so they would say, no, I'm not going to issue this warrant unless you describe what you're going to search. And so there's this dialogue that happens where these customs officials are writing to the Attorney General in the UK, and the Attorney General is writing back saying to the judge, you've misinterpreted the statute. The judge in many cases still wouldn't issue these warrants. This causes, thank you Townsend Act, the entire legal community in the colonies to have this point of view that general warrants are bad. And so when the colonies start to declare independence, they have this process of constitution writing, and it's a really important time in which a lot of principles of civil liberty that people may have recognized in English society but were not necessarily written down end up getting written down in an admittedly a haphazard fashion, but still a very important one, sometimes for the first time. And so in Virginia, the Declaration of Rights from 1776 says general warrants are bad and ought not to be granted. It doesn't say shall. Shall not, says ought not. So you probably shouldn't do that, but it. In 1780, John Adams writes this provision for the Massachusetts Declaration of Rights, and it's a little bit more similar to what we're familiar with, that the right to be secure against unreasonable searches, it defines, and it says, you know, again, like, unless the warrant specifically describes what's getting searched, it ought not to be issued. In 1789, we're creating the Bill of Rights for the Constitution, and James Madison writes the Fourth Amendment. When he does it, he actually writes an amendment that's a little bit broader in scope and a little stronger than the one that John Adams wrote. He says, not ought not, he says shall not be violated. So it's a very declarative thing. And he also creates this probable cause standard. So it's not just that they have to describe what they're going to search, they have to explain why they think they're going to find something valuable there. They have to have a reason for that. And so this is really, according to sort of constitutional historian Leonard Levy, who's in my references, he sort of put a flag in the ground in new territory here. He sort of said this is a broader conception of this right than previously existed. And Leonard Levy argues that he changed the mind of a lot of people in Congress when he did this. And so I told you there were going to be a few digressions here. I a few years ago came here and I talked about the search of electronic devices at U.S. border crossing. So right now, U.S. Customs says that if you're crossing the border, they can seize your laptop, your cell phone. They don't have to have any reason to suspect you of having done anything wrong. They could take them back and do a forensic analysis of them, and for whatever evidence of whatever. In addition, there's also this extended border search doctrine where Customs says that with 200 miles from the border, they can perform searches. So this happened to a friend of mine this summer. She was visiting a national park in Texas. She's American. She did not cross the border. She was at the park. She left the park, ended up in one of these random customs checkpoints. They had a drug-sniffing dog, which barked at her, and so they took everything in her car apart. Of course, she had no drugs. There was nothing there for them to find. The basis for these policies is a Supreme Court decision from the 1970s, and in that decision, the Supreme Court says this. This Fourth Amendment thing, this was created by the same Congress that a few months earlier had passed this Customs Act. And the Customs Act allowed for random searches of ships, and it allowed customs officers to get a warrant to search a warehouse, and they didn't have to establish probable cause. The judge was required to issue the warrant on the good faith of the customs officer. So the Supreme Court says if this Congress thought that was okay and they passed the Fourth Amendment, they must not think those ideas are in conflict with each other. They must be consistent with each other, and therefore our customs policies are also okay. So I'm sorry I made an announcement in the beginning. I want everyone to hold questions until the end. It's okay. I know some folks have filtered in after I got started. I got a lot of content to get through, so I got to manage time very carefully. So in any event, If you read historian Leonard Levy, he argues that that's not true. This passage of the Fourth Amendment invalidated that previous custom statute, and Congress never did anything like that again. And so, if he's right, the whole basis for these kinds of problematic searches may rest on an incorrect understanding of American history. Slight digression, back to the topic. You may be wondering, I've been sitting in this talk for, 23 minutes or whatever, and there's been nothing about the mail. What the hell does any of this have to do with the mail? The answer is it has nothing at all to do with the mail. The Fourth Amendment was not intended to cover the mail. There's an interpretation that when the Fourth Amendment talks about papers, they were referring to the mail. That interpretation does not occur until the late 1800s, and I'm going to talk about it. At the time, they weren't thinking that when they wrote this. However, secrecy of the mail was something that was recognized even much earlier than the American Revolution. So this is a royal proclamation from 1663, and it says, no person except by the immediate warrant of the principal secretaries of state shall open any letter or packet not directed to themselves. So postal employees are banned from reading the mail, but the secretary of state can issue a warrant to do so. This was echoed in another act in 1710, and as I mentioned, Benjamin Franklin ran the postal service in the colonies, and he required his employees to say an oath to this effect. In spite of that sort of footing, the British, in fact, did a lot of mail opening. There was a secret office in the British postal system. It created intelligence by opening and detaining mail and copying correspondence and sending copies to the Secretary of State. There were warrants issued by the Secretary of State. Some of them had hundreds of names. And sometimes these warrants not only called for the named individuals to be spied upon, but also all of their associates. In 1765, they got bored with the listing of names, and so they just issued a general warrant for all diplomatic correspondents in London. When this revolution thing got started in 1775, Lord Dartmouth, who was the American secretary, so he's the guy in the British government responsible for the Americas, he ordered the opening of all mail from America to England for the purpose of gauging public opinion. He wanted to see how widespread this revolution thing was. So all mail. This is a quote from a historian, and it's in my references, who wrote about this. He said, "Secrecy made legality unimportant." So a lot of the records of the mail opening were destroyed. It is not necessarily the case that everything was operating under a warrant. Eventually, they got real loose here. So this guy, William Goddard, was a newspaperman who built his own independent postal network in the colonies. And he wrote this essay in which he argued that, there was this parliamentary post that was run by the British government, and it's a threat to American liberty because they might intercept newspapers and delay news from being disseminated. So in the middle of a revolution, that would be bad because people would not know what was going on. Secondly, they might read the private correspondence of Americans and conclude they could construe private correspondence into treasonable conspiracies, is what he writes. So they might, make a big deal out of nothing and hang a bunch of people. And so this is bad. And so he uses the word constitutional post. He proposes the creation of a constitutional post, which is an American postal system. And he actually stands one up with his own money in 1774. And in 1775, the Continental Congress adopts it and starts funding it. And that is what becomes the U.S. postal system. So what's really important about this is that the U.S. postal system is born out of, in connection with the American Revolution, out of a concern that Americans have over the possible interception and reading of their mail by the government. Of course, the colonists were doing their own mail reading. The Continental Congress regularly received quantities of intercepted British and Tory mail. In 1775, they created this committee, which included some prominent folks like John Adams and Benjamin Franklin, to go through a bunch of mail that they intercepted that was Tory mail and decide which parts they want to publish in newspapers for propaganda purposes. So they had no problem reading the mail. They just didn't want their mail read, right? my civil liberties are important, yours, whatever. So, but what's interesting is that you know, a few months later, they're already seeing abuses in this practice. They already have a problem with this getting out of control, and they create some rules around it saying that only these specially designated prominent people have the right to engage in this behavior. It's not anybody who's working for the Continental Congress who's allowed to read mail. So they tried it. They put their foot in the water. It hurt, and they said, "Well, we better regulate this a little bit." So in 1782 is the first postal ordinance that's passed by the Continental Congress. It's kind of similar to the British ones. It says that, you know, people who work for the Postal Service shall not open the mail or detain it or delay it. But it does provide an official process for access to the mail by an express warrant from the President of the Congress or in a time of war from the Commander-in-Chief of the Army. So at this point in time, the Army can read the mail whenever it wants, as long as a senior official in the Army has given permission. So that's pretty, that's much broader than we have today. But that doesn't stay that way. So this is really interesting. There's a secret journal that the Continental Congress kept with provisions and resolutions that they didn't disseminate publicly. And in this secret journal, so there was this issue where after the American Revolution, so this is 1785, the American Revolution had been over for a year or two, John Jay, I think he was Secretary of State at the time, I'm not sure, but he was concerned that the government of Canada was encouraging their citizens to settle in places that had been conceded to the Americans in the war. And so he saw the Canadian government as a threat. He felt that they needed to be spied on. And he argued that some mail openings should be occurring and that this should be done in secret. And so Congress passes this resolution allowing the Department of Foreign Affairs to inspect letters in the post office. What's interesting is that it's related to foreign affairs, that it's secret, and that it's considered a temporary measure. And then a year later, they come back and they pass this again and they don't put an expiration date on it. So we have a tendency to do that these days. We create these temporary measures and then we come back and they're permanent. That was a problem even then. So, but the thing is that this is all before the Constitution is passed. When the Constitution was passed, it's not clear to me, you know, whether these things are still in effect. In 1792, they pass a new postal act, post-Constitution. This postal act says that if any person employed in the post office shall unlawfully open mail, then, you know, they would be fined. Now, what's interesting is that there is no more formal process for a warrant to be issued. They don't talk about warrants from the government. They don't describe any formal process for the government to access the mail. If you get real lawyerly in how you read this, you can note that it only applies to postal employees, so maybe other employees of the government are allowed to read the mail. And it says the word unlawfully open, which may imply that there is a lawful way for them to open the mail. But they never specified it. So maybe they meant to come back and fix that, but they just don't. Going forward, there was definitely a concern ongoing that mail was subject to being surveilled. This is Thomas Jefferson in 1798. He says, "The infidelities of the post office and the circumstances of the times are against my writing fully and freely. I know not which mortifies me most, that I should fear to write what I think or my country bear such a state of things." And so what I like about this quote is that he's saying that he's really uncomfortable with the fact that mail is surveilled. We know that Thomas Jefferson was into cryptography. This is what is supposedly a model of a Jeffersonian cipher desk. And so it's a pretty intricate crypto system for the time. He was influenced by stuff that already exists, but he put his own spin on it. And he influenced later cryptographic systems that were used by the U.S. military. This model, which they sell in at U.S. history sites, it's a little disappointing to me as a computer security guy because it's not accurate. You're supposed to be able to open it up and move the disks and the order of the disks. And if you can change the order of the disks, the cipher becomes much harder to crack. But in this model, you can't change the order of the disks, so you're kind of stuck in one mode. But it's still kind of interesting. I couldn't find it this morning. This is much more sophisticated than the ciphers that the Confederates were using during the Civil War, like 100 years later. They had a single disk. It was kind of like a decoder ring from your Ovaltine. It's interesting that Jefferson went to such lengths. Over time, what's interesting is that as the 1800s unfold, and I've done a lot of reading about this, it's not clear that there was a whole lot of mail surveillance going on, if any. So Stephen Knott argues that there was mail surveillance during the War of 1812, which you would expect, but the specific example he refers to is this thing called the Henry Letters. He says that the Henry Letters were, so James Madison spent $50,000 buying this thing called the Henry Letters. Henry was this British spy that the British didn't pay. And so he sold all of his intelligence to the Americans. And he sold it for $50,000, which was a ridiculous amount of money at the time. It was like enough to build a warship. The thing is that, the way that Knott describes Henry letters is that he says that they were intercepted letters from Americans who were sympathetic to the British. I've done some digging on that, and I can't confirm that that's true. What I see in other sources is that the Henry letters were actually Henry's own correspondence to the Governor General of Canada. He's selling a copy of his own mail. And so that's not really mail surveillance. That's me selling a copy of my own writing to somebody else. So I don't think that counts. I haven't found much else. The technology gets a little better. The Postal Service starts building these locked bags. And so when they're sending mail over long distances, it's in a locked bag from point A to point B, and there are people in the middle who transport it, but they can't access the contents. In 1825, they pass a new postal act. And this doesn't have the lawyerly stuff in the last one. It doesn't talk specifically about postal employees. It says any person. And it doesn't talk about lawfully. It just says opens the mail without, that's not theirs. And so, if this was sort of weasel wording around, the issue, the weasel wording was gone in 1825. And again, there was no formal process for the government to access the mail. So David Seep is a law professor who looks at he studies the history of law. One of his earliest writings was about privacy. And he says, this idea that no legal process, no executive order could detain and open a letter in the post office captured the popular imagination. And he quotes Ralph Waldo Emerson, who said, "To think that a bit of paper containing our most secret thoughts and protected only by a seal should travel safely from one end of the world to the other without anyone whose hands it had passed through having meddled with it." So really interesting, astonishing that maybe in the 1800s there just wasn't any mail surveillance happening. So this is in Congress, this is a congressman in 1876. He's talking about the Civil War. And he says, when repeated applications were made by local postmaster of the importance of ascertaining hostile proceedings through letters deposited in the war districts of the country, an order issued from the department prohibiting the slightest detention, delay, or tampering in any manner with such letters. Now, is this an authoritative source? No. It's a congressman speaking like more than a decade after the fact, and we all know how to tell if a congressman is lying. You see if his mouth is moving, right? So I don't know. What I can tell you is that in a lot of reading about this topic, I haven't found any contradictory facts. During the Civil War, newspaper reporters would use the mail as a way of avoiding surveillance of the telegraph. I'll talk about that a little bit more. So in 1878, there's this court case over the mailing of circulation of letters concerning lotteries. So they're doing lotteries through the mail. And the postal system didn't want to carry them. And they passed a law against it. And this guy went into court, and he said, the Postal Service has a monopoly on the distribution of letters. And if it has a monopoly, then it cannot censor. It must be a common carrier. They can't decide what to carry. And the court sort of weasels out of this position by saying that the Postal Service can decide what they want to carry and what not to carry, but they're not a monopoly. You can set up your own postal system if you want, and you can carry your lottery letters, but you can't use our postal system. It's kind of a let them eat cake proposition, because at the time setting up a postal system was a rather expensive endeavor. That was what they decided. And then they have a sort of, oh, by the way, that they include in this decision. And what lawyers use the word dicta to refer to when a court says, oh, by the way. They said, a distinction is to be made between what is intended to be kept free for inspection, such as sealed letters, and what is open to inspection, such as newspapers. The constitutional guarantee of the right of the people to be secure in their papers against unreasonable searches and seizures extends to their papers closed against inspection wherever they may be. So this is that argument that the papers in the Fourth Amendment refer to the mail. It's from 1878. Now, again, as I said, this isn't an originalist perspective. If you don't like lawyers legislating from the bench, maybe you might argue that this is judicial activism. But at the fact is that for 100 years, the sanctity of the mail had been widely respected in American society, and so nobody blinked about this. It was totally reasonable to constitutionalize this as part of the Fourth Amendment. Now, we have this this constitutional principle, which is great, but we don't necessarily understand it. And so the next topic is the telegraph. What about the telegraph? It's a new communications medium. It's extremely popular in the 1870s. One aspect of the telegraph is that it involved creating copies of messages because you had human beings relaying them. So the message would come into me, I would write it down, and then I'd turn over and relay it out the next route, human routers. And every time they had these paper copies that they would store. And so that became something that could be subpoenaed. And boy, were they subpoenaed. The Congress subpoenaed 750,000 of telegrams in 1876 in a real estate investigation. So the Hayes-Tilden election, which was in 1876, was highly contested. It was one of these sort of hanging chad kind of situations where no one was sure who really won the election, and the debate about it went on for years. And so there were 30,000 telegrams that a Senate committee investigating that was able to subpoena, and they did these dragnet searches where they read every single telegram looking for any evidence that something wrong had been done, and so tons of monitoring of the telegram system. There was fights over this. Western Union resisted it. There was a Western Union employee in Missouri who was held in contempt of court for refusing to turn over a large number of telegrams with communications involving a named set of individuals. Ultimately, they were forced to turn those over. In addition, you had, the 1870s, the Gilded Age was really this sort of age of corruption. You had a lot of political corruption. You had a lot of corruption in the corporate world. And Jay Gould is one of these Machiavellian characters who managed to slither to the top in an environment like that. And so he takes over Western Union, and he does it. So he runs his own newspaper, and he has all this sort of critical things that he's printing about them all the time to try to lower their stock price. And he uses some of his money to set up competing businesses, which they in turn buy, which causes him to get some of their capital. And eventually he manipulates the situation to the point where their stock price is low enough that he can buy it, and he just buys it out. And at that point, he ensconces himself in their corporate headquarters in New York City. It's one of the biggest, most beautiful, significant buildings in New York at the time. And it's also sort of a citadel because there's a bunch of people who are trying to kill him. And he's very safe in his fifth floor office up there. Once he's up there, he has access to all of the telecommunications that are going on in New York City, all of the market trading and the news related and secrets that are being shared about it. He can see it all. The Associated Press has an exclusive contract to use Western Union for their news dissemination. So he's in the middle of all the news. And so he's sort of like this steampunk corporate big brother. The telegraph is not a very private communications medium at the time, and the courts don't recognize it as such. The courts refuse to extend Ex parte Jackson to the telegraph, and they make a bunch of arguments, but really the core of their argument is that the postal system has been respected as this private thing for a long period of time, and that's our tradition. But the telegraph is new, and the tradition does not necessarily apply to it. It's not run by the government. It's not the same thing. And so they understand there's this tradition they're trying to uphold, but they don't really see it as a broad principle of the need to be able to communicate privately. They really see it as being about the mail. Congress debated legislation protecting telegraphs. They didn't pass one. So a lot of states did, but not in a way that made them legally privileged. Congress did resolve in 1880 that they would stop issuing dragnet subpoenas. So at least they decided that that was bad, but that's as far as they went. The telegraph was not protected by federal law until 1834. So in 1828, there's a Supreme Court case about wiretapping, and they conclude wiretapping doesn't violate the Fourth Amendment. Fourth Amendment's, they talk about eavesdropping. The Fourth Amendment doesn't mention eavesdropping. As a consequence of a lot of different things, but the Olmstead decision being one of them, there's this Federal Communications Act in 1934. And what it does is it says that it's illegal to intercept and divulge the contents of communications received through wiretapping. So that language is interesting because it's intercept and divulge, which led some people to conclude that interception is fine as long as you don't do the divulging. And so there's potentially a whole lot of wiretapping going on, but they can't use the results of the wiretapping in court. And they can't use it to develop evidence that they present in court. So it's stigmatized as an investigative technique, but it is not necessarily prohibited. Particularly from an intelligence perspective, a lot of it may have been going on. So this takes us to the 60s, Berger versus New York and Katz versus United States in 1967, where the Supreme Court says, no, wiretapping does violate the Fourth Amendment. And part of it is because we're getting to the point where let me take a step back here. You know, we obviously at the time of the American Revolution, our telecommunication system is the mail. We're concerned about the privacy of the mail. We build our own postal system because of it. We imbue into this postal system this idea that the mail ought to be protected from surveillance, and we actually do a better job of that in practice than the British did. In 1845, the British secret office is publicly disclosed, and there's a whole lot of controversy over it. It's not clear that the Americans had something like that. If they did, they kept it well under wraps from historians. So we've got this idea that communications privacy is important, and a lot of our intellectuals like Ralph Waldo Emerson believe that's meaningful in terms of their ability to communicate freely and to think freely. But we have these new technologies that come about, and we eventually get to the point where we constitutionalize this principle. It's now part of the Fourth Amendment, but we haven't really appreciated its breadth. And then over time, we consider these new technologies, and we get to the point where we have another piece of legislation, the Federal Communications Act, that kind of says, you know, wiretapping is also bad. And over a long period of time, we say, you know what, this is the same principle. We shouldn't be listening to people's phone calls. We shouldn't be reading their mail. Privacy is an important part of the freedom to think. And so eventually we get to the point where we now have this constitutional principle that communication should be private. And it's something that evolved over time throughout 200 years. And even before the American Revolution was a consequence of asking judges to recognize a right that had not been recognized before. So, this takes me to a few conclusions. I've gotten through this material a lot faster than I thought I would. Communications privacy and the Fourth Amendment have independent histories that are intertwined with the American Revolution. Long-term customs can coalesce into constitutional norms as individual human rights are first recognized by people and then become better understood. And so what the founders thought is a subset of what history teaches us. And it's a really important subset thereof, but the entire picture of what history teaches us is really what's important when we're asking ourselves whether these practices that we're engaged in today are right or wrong. So I have a few references. This is my primary reference. If you want to read about the subject, the number one thing, or you think I'm full of it and you want to go check my sources, read this paper by this guy. Anuj Desai is a law professor at Wisconsin Law School. He wrote this paper called Wiretapping Before the Wires. A lot of my content comes from it. It won an award in 2009 from the U.S. Postal Service given for scholarship in postal history. So it's been recognized as a significant source. There's a whole bunch of other sources in here, including Leonard Levy's book on the origins of the Bill of Rights, which is a great book if you're interested in the Bill of Rights in general. So I blew through this topic way faster than I thought I would, and now I got lots of time for questions. I know that somebody had asked one.
All right, we've got a remote microphone. It looks like a square Nerf ball. It's nice and soft. You can actually throw it across the room if you like. But I will run these.
Please
back
don't throw it at me.
Yeah, don't throw it at him. Yeah, this is not a weapon. But I'll bring it back for the questions.
You want to go first?
No.
Sure.
Okay. You'd mentioned that during the 19th century, and certainly through the first half, through the early Republic and antebellum period, there was a broad consensus, if not necessarily as much law, that the mail itself ought be recognized in private, and incrementally the Postal Service built up with sealed bags, etc. I don't recall all the dates, as I'm an idiot.
That's
and didn't
right.
bring a notebook.
Yep.
However, I'm a historian myself,
okay.
and this isn't a gotcha, but could you speak a little bit about the glaring counterexample that starts going in certain southern states in the 1840s and 50s, when mail inexplicably suddenly becomes a lot less sacrosanct when it comes from northern places and ends up in, say, Charleston, or Mobile, or Richmond?
No, great.
And somehow just never quite makes it to its recipient.
So I know a little bit about this. There was a debate that, because I looked at this from a very legalistic perspective, one of the debates that sort of preceded Ex parte Jackson, which is the decision that that the Fourth Amendment applies to the mail, was the situation in the 40s, may have been the 50s, where basically the southern states wanted the U.S. Postal Service to censor the distribution of abolitionist material in the South. Do you remember when Jackson was president? It was during Jackson's presidency, so maybe in the 1830s. Anyway, it doesn't matter. It's in that period of time.
Yeah, 28.
It was a corrupt bargain.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, so it was 1830. So Jackson supports this thing, but they can't decide whether or not it's legal. And so there's this argument that it would violate the First Amendment for the government to be censoring abolitionist material in the mail. And then this guy comes up with this argument that the government isn't censoring the mail. What they're doing is helping to enforce state laws. And so all we have to do is say the federal government is allowed to enforce state laws with respect to mail distribution, and we don't have to worry about that. But that argument is not successful. They don't end up passing a bill. And so the Federal Postal Service did not engage in any of this behavior, but certainly southern states did censor the mail. And to be clear, prior to the Civil War, the Bill of Rights did not apply to the states. So the states could do what they wanted to do, except with respect to their own constitution. So the southern states had no problem censoring abolitionist material, and I'm not sure about the specifics of them interfering with the Postal Service or where the state authorities would have gotten to interact with the Postal Service. But I mean, I could tell you in colonial times, like, they'd have like a tavern in the town, which is really just like a house with a living room, and there's a table, and then, you know, a kitchen area with some flasks, right? These things were small. And the postal guy would come with the mail, and he'd dump it on the table, right? And then if you had outgoing mail, you'd put it in a like box next to the door, and he'd take it. And all these letters are just kind of sitting around on the table, and it was very easy to have to thumb through them to find which ones were yours, right? So it would not be surprising if in the 1830s, like, it would be easy for locals to sort of intercept letters that they didn't want disseminated, because they were, I think, still being distributed that way largely. Does that help?
It does, and you've already confirmed. Well, my follow up was going to be: do you know anything about how the southern authorities actually?
I mean, I don't, but that's my conjecture, that like the way that mail was distributed was not actually very secure at the point of distribution. And they talk a lot about gossip in these bars where people would be reading each other's mail at that point. So, sure.
Thanks.
Can you go back on screen?
Oh. Sure.
So, hi, I am not a historian, so my question will probably be less smart. It seems to me that the trend that you've painted here is that privacy is sort of a belief that people latched onto and held, and then the legal system sort of caught up and eventually enshrined it in law.
Yeah.
Do you think that trend extends forward to technologies of today, perhaps electronic mail, where I think a lot of people probably think that they're not being read. Well, many people in this room might understand that they are being read widely, but might be enshrined in privacy further in the future.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that what's important about this is understanding that process. And it's an interplay between a couple of different things. First of all, it's like values, what people think is right and wrong. Secondly, like legislature, right? Like the fact that something might be illegal for a long period of time, and then constitutionalization. So, you know, in the 80s, there's this thing called the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, which says that, you know, the police have to get a warrant to read email. It is not until recently that there have been Supreme Court, or there have been court decisions constitutionalizing some of those concepts, like the idea that you have to get a warrant to read stored electronic communications. So that process is still going on, but with respect to this specific process that Professor Desai talks about, there's a long road to get to a point where something becomes constitutionalized as a principle. So it's not a case where you have this fringe, I guess, group that has this particular perspective that something is unconstitutional or trying to convince the courts. It's more that everyone buys into it, the legal system passes laws function that way over a long period of time, and eventually the court's like, look, this is how things should be.
I'm kind of piggybacking on that one and asking about the law trying to catch up to the technology of today.
Yeah.
That really struck me during your digression about the about customs officials searching your laptop and everything. Is it just the law not catching up to technology, or?
Yeah. So, that's a topic that concerns me personally a lot, and I came here and talked about it, I think, back in 2008. So that's an interesting one. So first of all, the idea that we have custom searches is something that evolved over time. We didn't necessarily have customs in the early part of this country's history. I know that by the Civil War, there were, if you were going into New York, there was this castle garden that you went to when you're coming in, and there were searches happening there that were instituted for revenue purposes during the war that were sort of kept on afterward. And so this whole thing of like custom searching your bags when you come into the country is something that developed over time. By the time you get to the 1970s, it's pretty institutionalized that's happening, and there haven't been a lot of challenges to it. In the 70s, you have the drug war going on, and that creates all these, you know, bad cases make bad law kind of situations where, they drilled into this person's gas tank, and it was full of marijuana. They didn't really know what they were doing. They just kind of randomly picked this person and drilled into their gas tank. Is it okay for the government to drill into gas tanks without suspicion? And the court's like, it was full of marijuana. We want to send this person to prison. So yes, that's fine. So we get this expansively. And one of the things that is frustrating right now is that if you are an innocent person and they don't charge you, you don't have standing to challenge the thing that you went through, right? Like it's only people who are guilty who end up being able to challenge the constitutionality of the search they were subject to, because they are the only ones who have standing to make those challenges. So so you end up with these people that the government wants to put in prison in court arguing about Fourth Amendment rights, and the all the other people who were innocent who were subject to these ridiculous searches, they're not able to form a challenge because there's no evidence to exclude from a trial. I believe that it's actually more complicated than in that specific case than the government failing to keep up with technology. It's a situation where they have this principle that people ought to be subject to search when they cross the border, and they think it applies to everything. And technology has made the consequences of that principle more significant than they used to be. But the idea that, well, maybe that principle isn't such a good idea anymore hasn't sort of dawned on enough people. And so I think that's hopefully that kind of helps, but it's a little bit of a different situation where we've evolved this principle over time, and now technology is making the consequences of that principle much worse than they used to be. Yeah, it's not like we have this principle that we apply to some technology and we just need to apply it to that technology. It's a situation where we have a principle that we are applying to this technology that maybe we shouldn't. So it's actually almost the inverse case.
So you struck me with something around expectation of privacy and privacy. So going back to colonial times, I'm getting a newspaper that's seditious in nature, but it's not wrapped, it's not enclosed.
Yep.
So, that's going through, but I'm getting it in a sealed envelope.
Yep.
Could you talk about that and then maybe bring it back to today with like encrypted emails, unencrypted emails,
yep.
The expectation of privacy angle?
Okay, so
would be great.
Absolutely. So in Ex parte Jackson, which is in the late 1800s, they draw a distinction between newspapers being sent through the mail in the clear and things that are put in envelopes. And they argue that things that are sealed from inspection, are not necessarily subject to the same ability of the government to filter them. So the fact that you put it in an envelope does affect your privacy rights. When we get to the 60s, when we get to Katz versus United States, they use the words that you just used. They use the reasonable expectation of privacy. And so that case involves, they weren't allowed to wiretap. What they did is they put a bug in a phone booth. And they knew the guy was making calls from the phone booth. And the argument that the court made is that the guy had a reasonable expectation that his voice would not be recorded in the phone booth, and that the Fourth Amendment doesn't just apply to your house, and they can't go in your house and put a wiretap there. It has this more loose idea of what is your reasonable conceptions about this context. When I close the door to that phone booth, I reasonably conceive that that I'm private in here, and putting a bug in there violates that reasonable expectation of privacy. So it's a little messy because it's this thing where it seems to relate to the word reasonableness in the Fourth Amendment, but the word reasonableness in the Fourth Amendment didn't originally mean sort of objectively reasonable. It had to do with whether or not it had to do with lawfulness. The founders thought very differently about it than the lawyers in the 60s did necessarily. It is a concept that gets applied today in Fourth Amendment law. It's like is it reasonable for you to consider this to be private? So I can take this to there's this interesting case going on right now where the law enforcement took over this child porn site behind Tor. And once they took it over, they were able to use malware to infect the computers of the people that were using the site. They've charged subsequently, a lot of these people. And like I said, you don't get to go into the court and make Fourth Amendment arguments unless, generally speaking, you're actually guilty. And so there's all these interesting Fourth Amendment arguments, perhaps, that are coming out of this. And the people who are making them are, quite objectionable, and everyone agrees they should go to prison. But the question is exactly what process should have been used here in this investigation, and was the investigation done appropriately, and how should these things be done in the future? And those are important questions. There's a judge who wrote this terrible decision that nobody has any reasonable expectation of privacy on the internet at all, because the internet is really insecure and people get hacked into all the time. And so if you're using the internet, you're pretty much owned, and so you might as well forget it. And that was his rationale for why it was okay for the FBI to do this, because the internet is a cesspool of malware anyway. I disagree with that point of view. As a computer security person, it's frustrating because we try to make the internet less of a cesspool. But I think it's a step too far. I think that you do have a reasonable expectation of privacy with respect to the stuff that's on your laptop. Just as much as you do with respect to the contents of a phone booth. But there are arguments about exactly what kinds of things construe a reasonable expectation of privacy. How does encryption play into that? I think what's interesting is that encryption doesn't just convey a reasonable expectation of privacy. It conveys, if done properly, a total reality of privacy. Like, it simply cannot be broken. And so it's a little bit of a different context. We don't necessarily require things to be encrypted in order to require a warrant in order to access them, for what that's worth. It was a bit rambling, but perhaps it touched on the things you were interested in.
Great. No, I wanted to understand the juxtaposition of I get an ISIS newsletter
yeah.
in the clear,
yeah.
and it's put in my email.
Right.
I mean, in my direct mail box.
Right.
Or I get it over the web,
right.
and you know everybody can see it.
Yeah.
I'm kind of stupid to expect people to not take action.
Our policy today does not make that distinction, right? It does not distinguish between I have an encrypted email and that's private, or I have clear text email and it's not private. We don't make that distinction. The policy today is the email going over the wire requires a warrant to access it regardless. But the distinction they do make is with respect to metadata. So in order to route that message, there's addressing information, and you know, in the Postal Service, the postman has to read your envelope in order to route it. And so that information is exposed to somebody else. And so that information, they argue, is available without a warrant to the degree that, you know, the NSA was pulling in everybody's telephone call information and storing it in a database. And our argument was, again, it's just addressing information. It's exposed to the phone company. You don't have a right to privacy to it, and we can collect it all. And so that's really where that debate has gone. It's really about, so there's a debate about whether, fine, the postman can read my individual addressing on my individual envelopes, but there's something different going on when you're collecting everybody's envelopes all the time and storing them in a database. Or is there, right? So that's where the debate has gone. But you make an interesting point. We don't, with respect to email, differentiate between email that's sealed and email that's not sealed from a Fourth Amendment standpoint. Today. Wrap it up.
Yep.
All right, thanks everybody. I hope this was interesting.